Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoeffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. Across the United States, we rely on electricity to power our homes and our businesses, and increasingly to support our mobility. As we pursue a low-carbon future, electric power will grow in importance. To understand how electric power is distributed and allocated in response to variations in demand and supply, we've invited James McCauley, who is London Professor in Electrical Engineering at Iowa State University, to join us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, a simple question for you, I think. Just what is the electric grid?
So, you can think about the electric grid in at a very high level in the United States as in terms of the three systems that comprise it. One is the Eastern interconnection or the Eastern system, and the other is the West, and the third is what we call ERCOT, but is an acronym essentially for Texas. So there's those three grids, and each one of those grids are fairly decoupled from the other ones. So there's a little bit of transmission between the three, but not much. But for each of them, you can think of four subsystems. We have the transmission system, which is the high voltage electric part of it that moves large quantities of energy. And then there's the distribution system, which is the lower voltage part of that, which is what you see running up and down your neighborhood streets. And then there's the generation subsystem, which includes all of the nuclear and fossil-fired units and, of course, the wind and solar. And then there's the load. The load which consumes the energy and is a growing active participant in the overall system. So maybe I'll stop there, and that's a kind of a high-level view of how you can think about the electric system.
That's a really good high-level view, and one of the things that occurs to me is you talked about the high-voltage and lower-voltage components, and my understanding is that for long-distance transmission of energy, there's an efficiency advantage in working with very high voltages. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's a great point. So the transfer of power, depends on the amount of current multiplied by the amount of voltage. So to get a certain amount of power, you either have high current and low voltage, or low current and high voltage. And it's much better for efficiency to minimize the losses in the line to have high voltage and low current.
Yeah, I remember the formula from 100 years ago, and I think, isn't it that the energy loss is proportional to the square of the flow of the amperage?
Right, that's right. I squared R, we say.
Yes, okay, so I don't want to pursue that any further because I think that's a limit of my memory of this. But tell me how the grid works. How does it assure that when I click on my air conditioner, that the energy to run it will be there?
Yeah, another wonderful question. So this is a fundamental part of how the grid works. We've never really had a significant amount of storage. We may be changing that in the near future, but given where we've come from without the ability to store energy, as soon as you flip that switch, the generation has to respond and provide that extra little bit of electric power to satisfy your lights that just came on. And so there is an automatic sensing of what we refer to as the frequency. And everybody knows probably the frequency in the North American grid is 60 hertz. And so as you increase a little bit of demand, then the sensors detect that in the context of frequency and increase the corresponding generators proportionally. And likewise, if you decrease your demand, then the frequency will go up a little bit. And that's detected, and that provides an instantaneous change in the resources or the generation part of the subsystems.
Is that why when my neighbor's air conditioner kicks in, my lights dim briefly?
No, that's a voltage issue. So there's a momentary surge in current, which drops the voltage at your home, and so you see your lights dim just a little bit, and then there's some automatic voltage controllers that will rectify that. So you typically won't see the impact of a frequency change. This is a fairly a difficult thing to detect by most users, but we will be able to detect it with frequency sensors in the grid. So this is a very important part of the overall control capability of the grid, and we have units, generation units, that are dedicated and are paid for supplying this exact service.
And this is an automatic function. That is, there's nobody flipping switches to respond to my extra demand for electricity.
That's right. It's an automatic function that occurs at most of the generation that we have. The exception, interestingly enough, is wind and solar. Typically today, wind and solar do not provide these services. But your nuclear plant, your natural gas plants, your coal plants, hydro plants, all of these will typically do, unless there's some exception, but most of them will be provided.
So I think I'm beginning to understand this, that when I consider wind and solar as a user, I don't have the capability either as a computer or as a person to kick on extra power. But I do with a controlled system like hydropower or nuclear generation.
Essentially, that's right. There's a little bit of a caveat. We could do it with wind and solar. The fact of the matter is that the energy is so cheap, it's more economically attractive not to do it with wind and solar, and let the other technologies take care of it. But as time goes forward, and more of the fossil fuel plants are retired, and more of our resources are wind and solar, something will have to be done. Either wind and solar are going to have to be providing this service, or we'll have to get the service from something else. For example, the demand, the load. I mentioned earlier that the load is becoming a more active part. The load has always been there, but it's always been a passive part of the system. But to think about making the load more active in the sense that as you increase your lighting load in your house, perhaps your neighbor might decrease something, or maybe even you in your own home might decrease some other load, maybe the air conditioning load, for just a little bit of time. Would be an example of how that could work. So this is kind of a thing in development, but is a thing that looks like it has a lot of promise for the future as more and more fossil plants are retired and more wind and solar units are coming online.
So you push the locus of control down to the user level as opposed to the generation level. Is that descriptive?
That's right. It's referred to as a demand response, or some people call it demand control.
So we need to put a marker on that. Maybe that's something we get back to. But going back to the way the grid functions, so does it ever not function? What can go wrong?
Well, all of us have probably experienced an outage or two in our lifetimes, maybe more. So certainly we do have electric power interruptions. Sometimes there are, you know, very, very localized, and only a few customers are affected. And sometimes, as you probably well know, you know, they can be very wide, widely distributed in a large geographical area, and many, many, many customers are affected. And in those latter cases, you have huge implications economically, socially, and politically, and quite often for the really big ones, you find the president, whoever that might be at the time, getting involved in talking to the utility companies. So it's a wide range of scale there of what can happen. But perhaps the thing that is of most interest to many of us, you know, are these what we refer to as extreme events. So the power grid is planned and operated for normal events. If you lose a line here, or you lose a generator over there, these things happen every day. And so we plan and operate the grid so that nobody gets interrupted for such normal occurrences of outages, of equipment failure. But when you get an extreme event, for example, what happened in Texas in, February, or you know, the hurricanes on the East Coast a few years ago, or we had a derecho here in Iowa back last August. So these things are, you know, rare, and it's really not economically wise to try to plan for them and build your system so that it completely sustains everyone's power under such catastrophic and extreme and rare events. So certainly things can go wrong. And it's kind of a social decision about how to spend money in order to minimize the impact of such kinds of events.
So going back to where you started in these three kind of distinct components of the national grid, can we in an extreme event like that, can we move power between those components?
Well, that is a tried and true concept that has been at the heart of power grid design for over a century now. And the essence of the thought is when my equipment fails, I'm going to ask you for help, and likewise, vice versa. So the essence of the idea is quite simple, and that is, you know, it's really a diversification issue. So I might be having an extreme event where I live, but you're probably not if you're 500 miles away, or even 100, or maybe 1,000. And so if we can somehow find a way to lean on each other, then my problems can be mitigated by your actions and vice versa. And so it's a really, really effective and tried and true method for facilitating, you know, such kinds of responses to these kinds of extreme events.
So are we doing this now?
Sure. The grid is interconnected, absolutely. And so, everywhere in the eastern interconnection, as I mentioned before, and everywhere in the western, and everywhere in ERCOT, Texas, you have the ability to provide assistance within that interconnection. Maybe two qualifiers there. One is it's a little bit hard for to provide very long range assistance like this. So if you want to move power from Minnesota to Florida, I mean, strictly speaking, it can be done, and the transmission is there. But the capacity of that transmission between, you know, that very long space you're going to run into roadblocks, so to speak, to lack of transmission capacity somewhere along the line. So it's a little bit difficult to provide large amounts of power that kind of distance. And clearly between the interconnections, between east and western interconnections, it's the capacity is almost zero, not quite, but very close to zero. And so if you want to move power from Iowa to Wyoming, you really can't do that today.
Does that explain anything of what we experienced in Texas in February of 2021?
Yeah, in some sense, it really does, you know, because Texas is isolated. It's its own grid. It's one of the three. And their problem in that event was a loss of generation capacity. It was an extreme event, and I have a hard time blaming them or, you know, blaming anyone for not being prepared for it, or having some kind of mitigation capability for it, but because it was such a rare event, who could have described or seen it coming? But if they would have been more heavily interconnected with the rest of the country, then there would have been more capability to mitigate the loss of generation capacity that they saw. It was a huge loss, almost, you know, unprecedented, the amount of over 30 gigawatts of, if you know what that means, of loss. And so it's just hard to imagine that this would have ever happened. But given that it did, and given that if they would have been interconnected with the rest of the country, there could have been some mitigation, some additional mitigation that they did not actually see.
So my understanding is that their being disconnected was a matter of choice.
So it is a matter of choice. It certainly could provide that. It's no technological constraint at all. So for whatever reason, I guess Texas has always seen fit to operate their grid in isolation. One of the reasons for that is that as a result, they are not under the jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the regulator at the federal level for electric energy, for electric power systems. So if you're not conducting interstate commerce in the form of electric energy trade, then you are not subject to the regulation of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And, you know, for better or worse, that they see fit in Texas to maintain their isolation in order to avoid that regulation. There's probably other reasons of which I'm not aware.
So my understanding is you've been doing research on macrogrids, and I don't understand the concept, but will that contribute to addressing these kinds of problems?
Thank you. I think so. Just to make sure we don't confuse terms here, there's a lot of discussion about what we refer to as a microgrid, and the term you just used is macrogrid. So micro meaning very small, macro meaning very large. So yes, I've been doing a lot of research in developing macrogrid designs for the United States. So what is that? So speaking to the concept of macrogrid, it's very analogous to the notion of the interstate highway system. So macrogrid is to electric power systems as the interstate highway is to road transportation. So before 1956, when President Eisenhower at the time implemented, got this legislation through Congress, which started our development of the interstate highway system in our country, for which we're all so familiar with now. It didn't exist before 1956. You know, your I-35, your I-80, I-75, I-85, all those interstates didn't exist. So now they do. And so same thing for the electric system. Right now, we don't really have an interstate highway system in transmission. What we have is equivalent to the, the two-lane roads, that maybe you drive 55 or 60 miles an hour on. So we have a very large integrated transmission grid in the east and in the west and in ERCOT with sort of this notion of a two-lane road, but not a long-distance, high-capacity, inter-regional interstate transmission grid. We do not have that today. And if we did, it would allow for very efficient and very instantaneous transfer of energy from any part of the country to any other part of the country. And so when you have a problem like they had in ERCOT, which was a loss of power generation capacity, you could pick that up by leaning on by leaning on the grid in Washington and Oregon, for example, or in New Hampshire or in Florida.
So my understanding of the way you just described it is that this would involve an investment in infrastructure in the capability to move power from place to place.
That's right. Significant. I mean, it would be a significant infrastructure enhancement relative to what we have today, not incremental at all.
Do you have a vision of how we would do this, how we would pay for it?
So that's in transmission. This is always a difficulty because, you know, transmission is a public good. Everybody benefits. And so who pays for it? And so In this case, it would be really hard to even identify a region that would be, the main beneficiary. It would be the benefits would be so widely distributed around the country. So there's different ways, but certainly bringing in some federal funding would be a useful way to facilitate the initial investment in this. There's also possibility of private investment, and that is actually ongoing today. There's a number of organizations that are building what I would refer to as segments of a macro grid design. Nobody has the capability to build a whole thing without the federal government and the states being behind it. But there are organizations that are building, that are proposing, and in some cases building segments of a macro grid. So if you put both of these two things together, A, government in the form of federal and state support, and B, private investment, and then C, of course, the electric utility companies would certainly bear a part of this through their customer base. Then I think it's very, very feasible thing to conceive of and possibly get going in the future.
It sounds to me like it's an investment in national resilience.
It's an investment in multiple ways, but you're absolutely right. Resilience is a major driver, but another major driver is economics. What studies have shown, I've done studies, a number of other researchers have done similar studies that clearly show such an investment pays for itself and then some. And so there's over a long period of time, there's a significant savings, and there's multiple reasons for that savings. But one of the reasons is that it facilitates the growth of wind and solar. So instead of building all of your renewables locally, you can build them where the resource is rich. Right? Not everybody has the same level of wind resource that the state of Nebraska has, for example, or the same level of solar resource that the state of Arizona has in the Mojave Desert, for example. And so building the construction development of the ability to move energy from one part of the country to the other like this takes advantage of building at the where the resources are riches. And this is a feature that is, of course, unique to renewables, wind, solar, and hydro. We have to build them where we should build them economically where the resources is richest. And so the macrogrid facilitates that. And by virtue of that, a single wind turbine, if you place it in Nebraska, is going to bring you it costs the same, but it brings you a lot more energy than that same wind turbine would bring you if it was in the middle of Alabama.
Also, there's a temporal factor here. It would seem to me that when the solar panels in Arizona are generating a lot of electricity, the demand in New York or on the East Coast is relatively high in the evening, and solar isn't going to work there in the evening.
That's right. So you can there's a resource diversification, and then there's a temporal. You're referring to a temporal diversification. So peak load that happens on the East Coast, the West Coast, or anybody in the middle, are 1 or more hours behind that East Coast peak, and so those more western resources can be used to supply that East Coast peak, and vice versa, and it works the other way too, right? That 9 o'clock p.m. the East Coast is past their peak, and so now they have resources to share with their western neighbors, who would then be experiencing their peaks. So there's a real benefit there of avoiding the need for building peaking capacity, And that is there's some very large savings associated with that that benefit.
It really makes a great deal of sense. Well, I wish you well with this. I hope that we will see a national product that gives us an interstate system for electric power. Jim, it's been a delight to talk with you. I could spend another hour, but I'm sure you and I don't have it. But I appreciate the education you've given us, and I hope we'll meet again on the internet. Thank you very much.
And likewise, I appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure, and I enjoyed it greatly.
Great. Thanks. Sure. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I.